I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Imagine living totally in the present, having no memory of the past and no conception of the future. For most of us, that is unimaginable. Having memories from our life and fantasies of the future are essential to our identity and well-being. But that is not how Lonnie Sue Johnson lives. 10 years ago, she contracted viral encephalitis that destroyed her hippocampus. Our guest science writer Michael Lemonick was intrigued by her story and what it is teaching us about how the brain and memory works. His book is titled The Perpetual Now. Johnson was a successful artist, musician, and amateur pilot before contracting the disease. And while she still draws and plays her viola and creates complicated word puzzles, she can't remember much of her own life. Michael Lemonick is opinion editor at Scientific American. This is his seventh book. He's been a guest on Radio Times on most of them. And Michael, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Tell us about the Lonnie Sue that you knew growing up in Princeton.
Well, actually, I didn't. So
you knew her sister.
I knew her sister a little bit. I was in high school with Lonnie Sue. I was a freshman when she was a senior, but I didn't know her. And in fact, all I knew was her name because I would read it on orchestra programs. And it was such a strange name. It just stuck with me. But I wouldn't have recognized her walking down the hall. Her younger sister, Aline, was 1 year behind me in high school. So we played together in the middle school and high school orchestras. And she's the one I know and recognize.
In fact, you begin the book with the sister telling you a little bit about her sister, Lonnie Sue. And in that moment, when she's explaining what happened to Lonnie Sue with the encephalitis, you write about what your memory did, and you went back and forth in time, and there you were playing your bugle and feeling embarrassed in front of the school auditorium audience.
Yep.
Such an interesting little snapshot about how our memory works.
Yeah, well, Aline has stayed in Princeton, New Jersey, where we both grew up, and
this
so have
her,
I.
Her sister, yeah.
The sister. And every 10 years or so, I would see her at the supermarket, and I would recognize her, and we'd say hi. And so, but we never actually talked. So she came up to me one day on the street a few years ago and told me this story about her sister. But seeing her face, just seeing her face and hearing her voice, triggered all of these vivid memories of especially middle school and the sound of the orchestra teacher's voice and that episode you just mentioned about standing in front of people blowing the – I mean, blowing in the sense of messing up.
I get it.
The bugle call every time. And so basically every familiar thing you see has a web of associations that can take you in many, many different directions. I only went into a couple of them in the book because it would have gone on forever.
Of course.
But that's what happens. And that's what happens to most of us who have normal memories. They're just – think smells or sounds or a song bring back a flood of memories of the past. And the other thing that happened then in that conversation was that having been a science writer for many years and knowing the story of this first celebrated amnesia patient known as HM, I said instantly, oh, this is another case of HM, the classic case. So it was intriguing right from the start.
And HM was a famous patient. He died, but had surgery and had his hippocampus removed and had been, I guess, in many ways, an example of what scientists look to try to understand how the hippocampus worked.
Exactly. So his hippocampus was removed to treat his epileptic seizures, which were really untreatable any other way. Nobody at the time, this is 1953, knew what the hippocampus did. They didn't think it had much of a function. They thought it had something to do with smell. And when he came out of this operation, he was in that same state you described earlier. He had only vague memories of the past, and he could not form new memories. So if you spoke to him and then left the room and came back, he would not know he'd ever seen you before. And if you did it 10 times in a row, he would still not know on the 10th time. And so immediately and suddenly, neuroscientists said, oh, that's what the hippocampus does. And his case was the foundation of the modern science of memory. It gave scientists a focal point to start looking at, and he was tested for the next 50 years. He died in 2008.
So really, Lonnie Sue Johnson, she sort of hurt what we're learning from her, picks up where HM left off?
Yes, and there were a number of other amnesia patients along the way who had similar kinds of damage. But the thing is that nobody has precisely the same amount of damage in exactly the same places, and nobody starts with the same background, the same functioning before they have the brain damage. So you have to look at a number of cases to really get a sense of what's going on.
So what happened? And she was clearly and still is in many ways a very creative person. In your book, you have some of the covers that were on The New Yorker that she illustrated, played the viola,
yep,
amateur pilot. So clearly a very creative, industrious, active kind of person.
Absolutely.
And this was about 10 years ago. She contracted.
So it was at the end of 2007. So a little less than that. But
okay.
Yeah.
She gets viral encephalitis.
Right. So it's a herpes virus that actually most of us have in our systems, and it's mostly benign. I believe it causes cold sores in some people and not in others. Every so often, for reasons nobody understands, it migrates to the brain where it begins to viciously attack the medial temporal lobes, which are deep in the brain, and that's where the hippocampus and surrounding tissues are. And it destroys those tissues and causes the similar damage to what happened to HM through surgery.
She was home at the time. I mean, what were her symptoms? What did it look like when all this was happening?
Well, she lived alone on this farm in upstate New York, and so nobody was there all the time to watch her decline. But she told people she had a terrible headache for more than a week. She felt very tired. People who came to visit her every once in a while noticed that she was behaving strangely. She was a little disconnected. She got angry at a friend whom she never got angry at before. And so it's not quite clear. But
right.
Basically, she had, as they say, flu-like symptoms, which just progressed and progressed. And finally, her business partner, a farmer, found her in her kitchen, making no sense at all, not being able to comprehend really what was going on around her. She started digging in a flower pot with a fork, for example.
Huh.
Nobody understands why. And he called a neighbor who worked at the local hospital, and they decided they had to get her to the hospital immediately.
So this disease destroyed her hippocampus?
Yes, yes.
So if we were to look at her brain?
Yes. So
what would it look like?
So funny you should ask. Once when I was accompanying her to a testing session at the Princeton Neuroscience Institute, they were doing fMRI imaging of her brain. And after the session was over, she chats with a scientist. She's very social. And she looked up at the screen and there was a picture of a brain. And she said, "Oh, what's that?" And they said, "Well, that's your brain, Lonnie Sue." And then she pointed to a big black hole of nothingness right at the center. And she said, "And what's that?" And I mean, what a moment. She is looking at her own memory loss in physical form. And they were very quick. They said, "Oh, you know, that's just some fluid in your brain."
Uh-huh.
But in fact, that's where the seat of her memory used to be.
I mean, it's just blackness.
It's black. It's like
there's nothing there.
There's nothing there.
So how?
Except fluid.
Except for fluid. So how did that change her, or did that change her personality? And we'll talk more about memory and all of that, but let's start with who she is.
Right. So as I told you, I could have known her in high school, but I didn't. Then she moved to New York and moved to upstate New York, and I knew nothing about her. You would hear about her every so often because she was a local minor celebrity.
Yeah.
Lonnie Sue Johnson, you know who that is? Yeah, of course. And she's just done some new cover for The New Yorker. But I didn't know her. I didn't know anything about her. And in order to compare her pre-disease personality, I had to talk to other people.
Right.
You know, I did not know what she was like. And so I talked to people who knew her as a child, people who knew her in New York when she was working as an artist, her ex-husband. She has no memory, by the way, that she was married for 10 years. But he has a memory. And so he talked about her friends in Cooperstown, New York, which is where she was when she got sick, and gradually started building up. And of course, her mother and sister were her primary caretakers until her mother died. And so they painted a portrait of this woman who, by all accounts, by everybody's account, was somehow had this magical quality that drew you to her and made you feel warmly to her. And that part of her is unchanged. That is exactly what you see in her today.
In fact, I was looking, you wrote about her a couple of years ago in Time magazine, and we were looking at some of the videos of her. So this is a couple of years old. And she's so warm when someone comes into the room. She welcomes them. She hugs them. Seems extremely relational. And I was wondering to myself, is Lonnie Hsu just a really good actress, or does she have very good skills sort of knowing how to greet people thinking, I do not know this person?
Yes, so that's something that amnesia patients often display. They have enough sense to know that somebody maybe looks familiar, because familiarity, it turns out, is different from ordinary memory. You can have that intact but not have explicit memories.
Not remember she was married, but
right.
Something more.
Right, but or you can say this person seems familiar, or this person is talking to me in a way that suggests that she knows me, so I will act as though I know her because I don't want to be rude. And at her mother's memorial service, there was a video shot of that. She is incredibly talented at that. So she meets somebody who knew her for decades, but she doesn't recognize her. And she said, oh, what's your name again? As though she just happened to forget. And the woman tells her, and she says, oh, yes, of course. How are you? She has no clue who she's talking to.
But she's a good actress.
She's got really good people skills, I think, is more like it. Yes, it's a sort of acting, but it's more of a making somebody else feel good by telling them what you know they want to hear.
She looks – I mean, cheerful has been the word to describe her, and she certainly, at least on these videos, she looks like a cheerful person.
Yes.
Does that seem accurate, or is that fantasizing how she is?
No, it is not fantasizing how she is. Of course, I only see her for brief periods, but from what I hear from her sister, she does get aggravated sometimes. She gets frustrated. She loves to do her drawings that she still does. She carries her papers and her pens with her everywhere. And if you try and make her stop drawing to, say, have dinner or, you know, do something, she can get a little cranky.
Yeah.
But overall, yeah, she's extremely cheerful and positive, and she's in constant awe at the beauty of the world around her, and she tells you about it.
Because she keeps sort of discovering it and rediscovering it? Can we
maybe
say that?
We can say that, but I don't know if it's true. But the thing is that she was like that before, and so it's a quality in her that is still intact. And maybe rediscovering it amplifies it. That's quite plausible.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about this really extraordinary story about a woman named Lonnie Hsu Johnson, a creative person, a musician, an artist as well, and about 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago, contracted viral encephalitis, and that destroyed her hippocampus. Hippocampus essential to retrieving old memories, creating new ones. The subject of Michael Lemonick's new book called The Perpetual Now, a story of amnesia, memory, and love. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Michael Lemonick about what Lonnie Hsu Johnson can tell us about our brains, our memories, our hippocampus. And again, his new book is called The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. Michael, I'd love to have you read a section from this book where you meet Lonnie Hsu.
I meet her for the very first time. So I knock on the door of her house and walk in, and this is what happens next. I see this woman sitting at the table, and she looks up. Okay, so... Hello, she said, her voice unexpectedly warm and rich and welcoming. My name is Lonnie Hsu, she said. What's yours? I told her. Then she asked, would you like to see my drawings? The table was littered with them, sheets of paper decorated with figures of horses, cats, fruits, stars, suns, moons, and letters of the alphabet. She began pointing the images out one by one, then looked up at me. Have you ever sung the alphabet? She asked. It's really fun. This woman clearly was not depressed. She seemed childlike in her openness and enthusiasm, but the drawings were exquisitely executed, and the alphabet song she proceeded to demonstrate was something no child could have pulled off. This wasn't the ABCD song we all learned as kids. It was something Aline, her sister, later said that Lonnie Hsu had come up with herself. She would start with a word beginning with the letter A and sing her way through the alphabet, one word per letter, all the way to Z. The song was always precisely 26 words long. Both the tune and the words were improvised each time and usually formed a sentence of sorts. Here's what she sang for me that morning, or at least the words. Artists beautifully creating delightful, exquisite finery, giving hospitable inspiration, joining keen laughter's monthly necessities, openly preparing quiet refreshment, sweetly turning under violet, weathervane, xylophones, yearning zestfully. It didn't make a lot of sense, but she performed it without hesitation, although she did stretch out a word once or twice as she reached for the next. By the time she was done singing the song, she'd forgotten that she wanted me to try it. This was the first obvious indication that something wasn't quite right. The second indication came a few minutes later, after she'd excused herself to use the bathroom. When she returned to the dining room, Lonnie Sue saw me standing there waiting for her. "Hello," she said brightly, smiling that same brilliant smile. "My name is Lonnie Sue. What's yours?"
I love that section, only because it helps us understand this cheerful person, but in many ways this extremely creative person, these puzzles and things. This was something that she made, that she created for herself after losing her hippocampus, it sounds like.
Right. So about 11 months into her recovery, she had regained language. You know, she remembered that. She could walk and talk and so on, but she was not motivated to do anything. And she had been driven before. She was a real type A person, driven always to be working and succeeding. She had no enthusiasm for anything. And one day, her sister Aline was out for a walk, ran into an old friend who, it turns out, writes puzzles for a living. She does these word search puzzles where there are words embedded in a grid and you circle them and find them. And so she said, "Well, you know, maybe Lonnie Sue would like to try some of my puzzles." And Aline said, "Yeah, maybe, you know, why not?" So she got some of those puzzle books, and Lonnie Sue devoured them. She just went wild, and she went through all of the books, and then she was desperate for more. So she said, "What should I do? I need more books, or should I erase this? And Mom, would you go out and get me some more books?" And her mother couldn't go out right away, and Lonnie Sue couldn't wait. So she started creating these word search puzzles by herself, which started out with just words and then added drawings and got more and more and more elaborate. And so her art came back through the alphabet and through words.
Is that how she then sees the world? I mean, through, in a sense, drawing it, creating words for it? I mean, is that how she is able to live as she does?
Well, I think, you know, without most of her memory, mm-hmm. There's not much she can do. And she can't draw on all of the knowledge she used to have to inspire her artwork, which is what she used to do. So she would do very not abstract drawings, but drawings that got at an idea rather than being explicit about it. And so she did a illustration for the New York Times once, for example, about the internet censorship, an article about internet censorship. So she used the Great Wall of China to symbolize that. Well, that requires knowledge, which she doesn't have anymore. And so she had no sort of underlying inspiration for her work. But once she discovered the joy of the alphabet, I think, is something she can manage because you don't have to think about it. If you say the alphabet, you are not thinking, "Oh, what comes next?" I mean, it just rolls off your tongue because you learned it when you were so young. So she has that as kind of a scaffolding that she can build upon to do other things. And by focusing on words and the alphabet, she can then get inspiration to do more.
As you were describing that, I was thinking of an interview I did with Temple Grandin. And I mean, she's been interviewed by everybody, so she didn't say this uniquely on Radio Times. But she talked about how she thinks about things, and she thinks in pictures. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is how she – like the idea of liberty, for her, is a picture of the Statue of Liberty or something like that. That's her way of representing the world. And what Lonnie Sue seems to be doing seems in some way connected to what Temple Grandin does.
Yeah, it seems that way. I wonder if in both cases – so Temple Grandin has autism, right?
Yes.
And Lonnie Sue has this brain damage and memory loss, which are obviously not the same thing. But I guess the brain feels the need to make sense of the world, and you do it with whatever tools you have. And if Temple Grandin can't think in abstract concepts, she goes for the concrete, which she can use. And Lonnie Sue can think about the alphabet because she can, that she knows backward and forward.
But what's so interesting about Lonnie Sue is that she's, there are certain skills that she's been able to retain. So she can still play the viola. In fact, might be a better musician today than she was 10 years ago. So help us understand what, so she can't remember that she was married.
Right.
But she can remember to play her instrument.
Right. So one of the things that we learned from HM, that original amnesia victim, which psychologists really suspected, but he proved it, was that what we think of as muscle memory, how to ride a bike or how to walk even. I mean, you don't think about how to walk. You just do it. And you learn – so it's a very fundamental part of your brain. And it turns out that that sort of memory for skills, which playing the viola is managed by a different part of the brain than the hippocampus. And so when you destroy the hippocampus, you might not be able to remember who killed JFK or even that there was a JFK, but you can still remember how to walk and you can still remember how to talk and your vocabulary is still there. Those are things you don't explicitly think about. They're just in there somehow. And I don't know if she's tried riding a bike, but she certainly has that skill. Mm-hmm. And she can also draw beautifully. Again, it's a muscle memory kind of thing.
You ask her about flying, I mean, what it was like when she was an amateur pilot and she could fly, was allowed, I guess, to fly an airplane. And her description is pure poetry. I mean, what she describes is not the mechanics of flying, but that feeling of flying.
Yes, yes. In fact, she likens it to playing the piano.
Because, exactly.
Yeah, because when you're flying, you've got two hands on the stick or the wheel and 2 feet on the rudder pedals, and you're sort of swaying back and forth with the wind. And when you play the piano, you've got two hands on the keyboard and feet on the pedals, and you sway, and it's a very similar kind of thing. It's remarkable to me that she can make that kind of poetic comparison.
She is part of research that has been done. I'm assuming this – does she have to give her permission in order to be able to be a part of this research?
Right. So she really doesn't have the capacity to do things like sign a contract or give permission. But her sister has power of attorney and all. Her sister is empowered to make decisions for her. And so her sister and her mother, again, when she was alive, she died in 2015, decided that they wanted to participate in research because they wanted to call attention to the brain and brain science, make something good come out of this tragedy. And so they decided that Lonnie Sue would be willing to participate. Now, if
– Knowing her? Knowing her as they do?
Knowing her as they do and if she – got upset a lot or showed a lot of discomfort or said, please don't make me do this, they would not have done it. They would certainly have respected her wishes in the moment. But she is the best research subject in the world.
Why is that?
Well, because she thinks it's a blast. You know, put me in the MRI. This is great. She lies in there singing to herself. And she's just – one of my sources, a neuroscientist, said that she went to a conference and described Lonnie Sue and what kind of a patient she was or what kind of research subject. And the others were like, you are so lucky because people with brain damage are not always particularly cooperative. They're frightened or they're disoriented. She's happy. Yeah, throw me in there. That's great.
And she gets asked lots of questions too about what she remembers or how – I guess perhaps how she remembers what she remembers.
Yes, exactly. And she also is we talked about the fact that she can't form new memories, but that's not literally true. So if something's repeated often enough, she will finally get it. So she now does know her father died. She didn't at first. She knows her mother died. And through repeated research sessions, each time her sister and the scientists explain that what she's doing will help other people or might help other people, right, the research on her. And she's got that now. So she'll now say at every research session, will this help other people?
Oh.
And they said, yes, it will. Oh, great. Okay. So she's all in.
Talking about memory, it's interesting. She's asked about September 11th. And over time, she begins to, I don't know if remember is quite the right word, but she begins to associate something bad happened that day. And walk us through sort of her recognition that September 11th was a significant day.
Right. So one of the scientists who is studying her taped a session at Johns Hopkins, and he asked her, you know, what do the words September 11th or 9/11 mean to you? And first she said, well, I don't know. He said, well, you know, think about it. You know, just try. So, well, did something bad happen? Remember, he's not prompting her at all. He said, well, keep going. You know, that's good. Keep going. And gradually over a period of 2 or 3 minutes, she says, well, was it a war? No, it wasn't a war. Was it an earthquake? No, it wasn't an earthquake. And then suddenly, out of seemingly nowhere, she says, did a plane crash into a building? And so it's in there somewhere.
I was going to say, where was that? Yeah, was that little fragment of memory?
Well, the thing is that the memories that she had before this accident have not disappeared. So when we form a memory, we have inputs from our eyes and our sense of touch and our ears and maybe our sense of taste and smell. And those all come into our brains through different, organs. And they're processed in different parts of the brain. And that whole experience is knit together by the hippocampus. But the actual fragments still live in those parts of the brain where they originally came in.
You've written about how you misremembered the Challenger explosion, and that's one of those tragic events. I think we all sort of remember where we were, what we think we saw, what we think we heard, or what we were told. You're saying perhaps we should be a little more cautious about the accuracy of our memories.
Yes. Well, so it's not that we think we saw. We are sure we saw.
Exactly.
You know, and I can tell you exactly what happened to me, exactly where I was and what I did next and what I was thinking when I learned of the Challenger explosion, and also of 9/11, and also when JFK was shot. I'm that old.
And, me too.
Not Pearl Harbor. So
there you go.
But for my parents, that was another one. And it's vivid. It's like a movie playing in my head. And it turns out that we all have those memories, and almost always, at least some of the details are wrong. Not the general. I mean, I was in my parents' bedroom when JFK was shot. I was in my office in New York when the Challenger exploded. So the basic outlines are correct, but many of the details, it turns out, we get mixed up with stories that other people told us of that same day, or something we saw on TV, or so that the timeline and the chronology. So we can trust the memories, but we can't really trust all of the details.
Hmm. You know, that reminds me of interviews, again, that I've done, this having to do with eyewitness testimony. And the idea, more and more people are thinking that eyewitness testimony is not as reliable as was once thought, I think, for exactly what you just described there, especially for something like a traumatic memory.
That's exactly right. There's a psychologist named Elizabeth Loftus who did pioneering work in this area starting more than 20 years ago, in which she did experiments that showed definitively that people's specific recollections of eyewitness events, mostly things that she showed them on video, for example, are not reliable in many of the details. And she even learned how to implant false memories in people simply by suggesting them. And after that, people thought for sure that they had actually had those memories. So when you're absolutely sure you remember something, some specific event, you might not quite.
So what is memory?
Yeah, I know. Well, it's
what is that?
Yeah. The point I made in that thing you read about the Challenger is that evolutionarily, it was not important for our evolutionary ancestors to remember in great detail what happened the time the cheetah attacked me over by that rock.
That wouldn't be important?
It would be important to know that a cheetah attacked me there, right? And that be careful around that rock. But what he looked like and, you know, whether he snarled first and then jumped or jumped first, then snarled, or, you know, what the sky looked like, or, you know, what song was going through my head, all of that is really irrelevant. That's a sort of a layer on top. And it's really important for storytelling, which is what we do and care about, but it's not important for survival.
Huh. Interesting. So is Lonnie Sue then, is she the new HM in that this is the person that scientists are looking at to help us understand the brain and memory, hippocampus, all of that?
Yeah. I mean, HM was the first. So he was unique and nobody had any other patients like him at the time. As I said, we've had others since then. She is not the only one people are looking at, but she is unique in that she had so many different skills and experiences and talents before she had her injury. And also she lived most of her life. She was in her late 50s when this happened. And HM was only 27. And his highest achievement was to work on an assembly line. So there are many, many, many more aspects of memory to test with her. So they've tested her, for example, on how do you make a watercolor? And she can tell you in perfect detail. First, you prepare the such and such, then you do this, then you do that. Or rules and regulations of flying. She remembers many, many of those. And music. And so it's almost unlimited. And creativity. I mean, that's the thing that they're really excited about. She was incredibly creative. And nobody's really been able to test amnesia victim with that kind of creativity.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I see a lot of people want to join us as well. Michael Lemonick is our guest, and his new book is called The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. And it is about a woman named Lonnie Sue Johnson, a very successful artist. She contracted encephalitis, and she has memory loss, but we're learning a lot about how all of our memories work. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Michael Lemonick. He's opinion editor at Scientific American. He's just written his seventh book. I think, Michael, you've been a guest on the show on most of the other books that you have written, this one called The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me take Rick, and then I'll read some comments here. Rick from Warminster. Go ahead, Rick. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Rick. All right. I will read Rick's question, which is he wonders to know whether our mind is like a Rolodex, that your mind reacts to physical actions. Is that a helpful metaphor that our mind is? I guess a Rolodex is in the old fashioned way you could flip through them.
Yeah. I wonder how many of our listeners remember them.
what a Rolodex is.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, so our minds certainly do have. No, I think actually that's not useful because in a Rolodex, each card has some information and then you go to the next card, has different information. And our minds are much more intertwined than that. So it's like a Rolodex where you look at a card and it could lead you to any other card, which could lead you to any other card in a complex web of associations.
Well, in fact, you have a description in this book about visiting your stepson who lives in central Pennsylvania. And how over time you begin to sort of learn without having to check your map or GPS about how to get there. Is that more helpful, perhaps? Our mind is a map.
Well, yes, that's actually more helpful. Although what you described is more interesting to me because it shows an entirely different kind of memory than the memory for explicit facts or the muscle memory we talked about earlier. There are all sorts of aspects of memory that we don't usually think of as memory, but the internalizing of information so we no longer have to think about it, that's a different form of memory. And one of the things we learned since HM is that it's not just muscle memory and explicit memory. It's much more complicated than that.
In fact, it's the kind of memory you have, I think it's called highway hypnosis, where you're taking the same route every single day and you frankly sometimes can't remember how you got there,
right.
But clearly you did, and
right.
No one died.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly.
Let me see what Evelyn from Philadelphia has to say. Evelyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I knew Lonnie Sue and taught her the viola in Philadelphia for, I don't remember how long, in the 80s sometime.
Really?
And I just wanted to second everything Michael Lemonick said about her absolutely wonderful, radiant personality. And I know you have many, so I'll get on to my questions.
Sure.
I wish if I thought she'd remember me, I'd love to write her. But I guess she wouldn't. So anyway, I am a violist, of course. And can she read music? I understand the muscle memory, but can she read music?
Evelyn, it's a great question.
Can she learn new music?
Yeah, it's a great question. Go ahead, Michael.
And my one other question is, would she recognize by ear the Beethoven Fifth? That's all.
Sure.
Okay.
Fair enough. All great questions.
I wish I had spoken to you when I was writing the book. That's wonderful to know that you taught her viola. She can read music. She can learn new music. And in fact, that's one of the tests that the neuroscientists put her to. They had a violist compose a piece of music that nobody had ever heard before. And they had her sight read it. And what they found was that when they showed her the music a week later, she had no memory of having seen it before, but she played it better than she had the first time because she had learned somehow without her hippocampus. She had learned the music without knowing she'd learned the music.
That's so fascinating.
It really is.
Would she recognize, do you think, Beethoven's Fifth?
I do not think she would, because they also tested her on familiar melodies. Not necessarily that one, but they played a number of melodies like Happy Birthday and Mendelssohn's Wedding March, which are associated with occasions, and said, well, what does that go with? And she just didn't know. Or Pomp and Circumstance is another one. She just didn't know when you would play that.
Is she a better viola player now than she used to be, than she was?
No.
Or is she able to kind of retain some of those skills?
She's not better than she was. That would be truly amazing. But she is quite good. And in fact, at her mother's memorial service, she played a Bach piece just exquisitely. And the audience was blown away.
Does she have emotions?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, she's happy.
I mean, besides being happy.
Right. Well, as I said, she can get annoyed. She can be sad, when thinking about her mother or her father. Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting to have a hippocampus, to think about someone who doesn't have one. I mean, to try to put oneself or put myself or yourself into the absolute present and trying to imagine what that feels like, because it's actually impossible.
Yes, it is impossible. It is impossible. So I could just describe how she acts. And, one of the things I did talk to a neuroscientist about, who studies consciousness. I want to know, it's sort of getting at that question. Is her consciousness fundamentally different from ours? And he pointed out that, first of all, she's not aware she has this huge memory loss. So it's not like she's going all the time, well, what about my childhood? She doesn't even think about it because it's not there and it's not part of her consciousness. But that for most of us, so we're sitting here talking and I am in this moment, in this conversation, and I'm not thinking about, the mortgage or what I'm going to have for lunch, because I'm on live radio and I don't want to say something stupid. And so at this moment, I'm not that different from her.
Right.
And so there's more in common with her and with the rest of us than you might think.
You mentioned that she just loves to draw and do these word puzzles all day long. Would she forget to, not know to eat if someone didn't remind her?
Absolutely.
She would.
Oh, yeah. And in the converse is that they tried an experiment with HM, which some people think was a little bit unethical. They would feed him lunch and then take it away. And then 10 minutes later, bring an entire second lunch and he would eat it because he didn't remember eating before. And then bring him a third lunch. And so it's that sort of thing.
A bunch of questions here. One is, can she use technology? I mean, we see her drawing and with all her art supplies.
Right. I do not believe she uses a computer or a smartphone. In fact, smartphones are being pioneered at a couple of places as aids for people who have this kind of memory loss. So if you see somebody and you don't know who they are, but your smartphone has face recognition, it can tell you. She has not participated in any of that.
Oh, but that's interesting that could, and I think as people get older, your memory seems to feel like it's not as reliable as it used to be.
Right. And there are some similarities with Alzheimer's with her condition and many differences, but that technology is also being used for Alzheimer's patients.
A question about her about a hippocampus. Let's say it's damaged. Does it repair itself? Can it repair itself?
Not significantly. Not significantly. You know, the brain can rewire itself, but it can't rebuild itself in a significant way.
And a question about her memory. So do her memories last for 10 seconds, 2 minutes, 5 minutes? Do we know?
You know, it depends on the kind of tests you do. Certainly, and you know, it depends on whether you're with her continuously. So if you're in a conversation with her, all she has to remember is who you were a minute ago. And so whereas if you leave and come back, it's discontinuous and she's distracted. Few minutes, I think, is fair to say.
Let me see. Oops. I thought we had a caller there. Let me read another email about a guy, Richard, saying my sister, 65 years old, experienced an episode of amnesia. I found this fascinating and scary, of course, which I think gets to the question about the family. I mean, clearly, Lonnie Sue lives in her world. She had a mom who died a couple of years ago, who was very involved in her life.
At the age of 97, she died.
Oh,
wow. This happened when she was 90, and she was tireless. She was an amazing woman, but yes.
And a sister who was clearly very involved.
Very involved.
So what has been the effect of what happened to Lonnie Sue on her family?
So her father died a number of years ago. They've got relatives, but it's not a big, boisterous, family that gets together for huge occasions. So it was really just the three of them. And of course, it was devastating, but it also brought them together.
That's the love part of your subtitle?
That's the love part, absolutely.
Where they were just completely involved in her life. And we see her mother sort of working with her. Her mother was an artist as well.
Yes, she was. What shocked me, because I'd seen Aline and Maggie, the mother, with Lonnie Sue and involved in everything and, just from the moment she got sick. And I said to Aline, well, you must have been very close as children. She said, no, actually, we weren't particularly close.
Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, it really drove them together in a very big way. And I forget your other question.
Well, that's okay. Isn't that interesting? Here we are talking about memory.
Yes.
And I'm struggling here trying to remember my questions as well. But would you say her family suffered as a result of what happened to Lonnie Sue? I mean, to watch her clearly lose so much, and obviously she's gained things back, but there are things of obviously she cannot do anymore.
Yeah, well, they certainly suffered. They felt terrible for her, and it was a physical ordeal for them because for months they were going up to upstate New York where she was in various hospitals and rehabs, and Aline had to sell Lonnie Sue's farm and all the paperwork and liquidate. I mean, it was a massive, massive mm-hmm. undertaking. But ultimately, they ended up spending much more time together and really becoming closer as a family. Mm-hmm. So some good came of the tragedy.
Let me see what Daniel from Jenkintown has to say. Daniel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Fell off. I didn't fall. A horse fell down on me when I was riding a horse. I was all alone. And I had total amnesia when I came to. I didn't quite realize what had happened. When I sat up, I was just amazed how beautiful the whole countryside looked. It was magical. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
And I realized there was something wrong because I didn't know my own name. And
I'm assuming, Daniel, it came back to you. I mean, you now remember what happened, and you're Daniel from Jenkintown, right?
Right. It took. I didn't know which way to go. I figured out there'd been a horse and there'd been an accident, because of the marks on the ground. The horse had fallen and flattened the grass. And I saw the hoof prints. There was a building, but I couldn't figure out what the building was.
Wow, wow. Well, I appreciate
started walking and eventually got somewhere, and people, started helping me put things back together.
Well, I appreciate the call into Radio Times. And I think for a lot of people, Michael, I mean, there are these moments, concussions. Sometimes we hear about young kids getting concussions and getting whacked or sat on by a horse. That can do things to the brain.
It can. But as you said, pointed out, you recover from that.
Right.
And it's not unusual. There's another kind of transient amnesia that hits people later in life, their 50s and 60s. And in fact, one of Lonnie Sue's good friends, who played in an orchestra with her in Cooperstown, who's also a doctor, told me that it happened to him once. And for several hours, he didn't know who he was. He didn't know where he was. It didn't upset him. He was sort of fine with it. But his wife realized there was something wrong, and then it just passes.
So what is that? Like a little hurricane in the brain
or
something?
Yeah, I don't think they know what causes it. And it generally doesn't repeat. But it's not uncommon, so be prepared.
Thinking about Lonnie Sue, I mean, I'm assuming her brain like our brain? I mean, everyone's brain is essentially the same architecture. But is there something unique about her brain because she was and is so creative, for instance?
Probably, but nobody's been able to quantify that sort of thing. Clearly there was something different, and so she had a different baseline from some of those other amnesia victims we talked about. There's actually one famous case in the 80s in England, a guy that Oliver Sacks wrote about more beautifully than I write about Lonnie Sue.
Your book is just fine. Well, but yes, go ahead.
but he was a musician also. So he had that sort of level of talent. But the thing is that he got encephalitis, but he was so terrified at not knowing what had gone before that he basically couldn't be studied. He was agitated and he was just a mess. And so there's a personality thing going on as well.
So do you think differently about your memories, how you remember, what you remember, having written this book?
Well, I certainly realize that it is more fragile than I ever would have thought. And I think more about it when I am recalling memories.
I think,
oh, this is what's going on. This is what I've learned. And I don't trust my eyewitness memories anymore nearly as I did.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Such a fascinating story. Michael Lemonick, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. And the story is about an extraordinary woman named Lonnie Sue Johnson, lives in the Princeton area. And we've been talking about what happened to her when she contracted viral encephalitis and what scientists, researchers are learning from doing research with her on her brain. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thank you for joining us.